Okay, Rabotze, I think we are ready to give it a run. What do you say? Shavuot Tov Mevorach. And tonight's daf from Eretz HaKedesh in Masechet Ketuvot is daf Nun Aleph, Nun Beis, and we're holding on Nun Aleph Omud Beis, right at the bottom, one line up from the bottom. Okay, so the Mishnah was talking about the various clauses that are invisible to us in the Ketuvah, but are held in the Bezdin's document, so to speak, the virtual document of the Ketuvah. And one of them was the insurance policy against kidnapping. And we saw that there was a difference between a Kohen's Ketuvah and a Yisrael's Ketuvah. A Yisrael's Ketuvah promised that in the event of your being kidnapped, I will pay the ransom and bring you back to be my wife. But in the Kohen's case, the Ketuvah, of course, cannot have the Kohen promising to bring her back to be his wife, because the din is that a shvuyah is asura to a Kohen because of the chashash that she was raped, and there for Kohen, that would turn her into someone who is asura to him. So what it says over there is not that I will bring you back to be my wife, but rather, as opposed to utvinach leintu, I will bring you back to be my wife, ahadrinach ledinatech. I'll bring you back to your place. But I can't, of course, go against the Torah and take you as back as my wife. Now, the question is, in a case where the marriage to the Kohen was prohibited, now this is a fascinating thing, because if you consider the implications of these two wordings are actually very powerful for other issues. Because the way in which it's worded does not only make a difference in terms of what it is that he's promising vis-a-vis himself taking her for a wife or not, it also makes a tremendous difference in other things, as the Gemara is about to show. Because an almana who got married to a Kohen Gadol, now she is asura to him anyway, right? So she, he can never be married to her, even in the first place. He wasn't allowed to be married to her, and the entire time that he was married to her, it was an isur d'oraisa, and it was a be'ilat znut, and so on and so forth. Nonetheless, remember that the ketuvah is split into two completely different elements. One element of the ketuvah is the way that a woman is treated during her marriage. And the other element of the ketuvah is what happens when the marriage is dissolved. So therefore, when a Kohen is married to someone who is asura to him, the parts of the ketuvah that are there in order to facilitate the dissolution of a marriage, those remain in effect, because that's what we want anyway. And the parts that are there to provide for a woman during the course of a marriage, those are canceled, because we don't want her to be comfortable there. We certainly do not provide her with an income, we don't provide her with food, and so on and so forth. So now the question is, what about this clause about the kidnapping? Is that provided to the wife of a Kohen who was asura to him from the first place, for instance, an almana to a Kohen Gadol? So Abaye says, look, if you take a look at the way that the promise is in the insurance policy, it was never to take her as a wife. It was basically a promise to bring her back, but to divorce her. Well, that's great. So then that means that this is part of the dissolution of the marriage, part of the ketuvah, and therefore remains in effect. So an amana to a Kohen Gadol over there, he is chayev to redeem her, but to pay the kidnappers for whatever ransom they want, because anikoreba, in the wording, ubekohenet, as the Mishnah said, quote, adrinech ledinatech, I will not marry you, but I will bring you back home. So, fine. What's wrong with that? That's what he still has to do. In the case, however, of a mamzeret and a tina to a Yisrael, even though the ketuvah is in effect over there as well, the parts of the ketuvah that are the dissolution of the marriage ketuvah, over there, the ransom insurance is not provided. Why? Because what the insurance policy says in the ketuvah is that I will bring you back and marry you, make sure that you remain my wife, which is precisely what we don't want. She's not allowed to be. She's a mamzeret. She's a netinah. And because of this, that part of the ketuvah surprisingly is canceled in the case of Yisrael, where it remains in effect in the case of the Kohen, which is fascinating because it's a completely unexpected result of the change in terminology of the insurance policy. Fascinating. So that means there's a fundamental difference. It's not just a question of the marriage per se. There's a fundamental difference in the policy that's provided by a Kohen than that which is provided by Yisrael. Rava says, wait a minute. I mean, the question is, what exactly is the reason that I am not bringing her back to be my wife? The point is that Kosha Isur Shivya Goremla, then Chayav Livdota. If the only thing that put into effect the specific wording for the Kohen, that I will not take you back as a wife, but I will bring you back home, is the fact that she was captured, so then he has to be po to her. But you can't apply that language to a completely different situation, which is the fact that she was never allowed to be with this husband anyway, and say, well, I mean, but it covers that too, right? I mean, that's coincidence, really, that it covers that. That was not the reason that we instituted the difference in the policy. And because of that, it doesn't make sense to say that, therefore, we should be mechayev a Kohen who's married to an Israel, Kohen Gadol to an Almana. He is not, according to Rava, mechayev in the condition of the ktuvah, the clause of the ktuvah that says that he has to pay the ransom, because she was asura to him even before. And therefore, the fact that it happens to fit the words in the policy is not a good enough reason. And therefore, it's the same as the case of Mamzeres and Atinatu Yisrael, basically. Now, that is fascinating machloket. Is it possible that this machloket is between Abaye and Rava about whether the wording of the insurance policy in the ketuvah can be understood as including an Isser Chatnut for a Kohen? Could it be that it's actually a machloket tanoim? Take a look at this case. Somebody was Madir et Ishto. So over here, he had made a neder that he's not allowed to be nene. She cannot be nene from him at all. Now, that kind of neder basically guarantees a get. Somebody makes a neder like that, she has a right to sue for a get and so on. And that's the first step towards divorce. So at that point, I mean, he's not allowed really to remain with her because she's not allowed to get any benefit from him, which violates every chiyuv of the ksuma that's there. So what would be the din if she was kidnapped? Finish bait. So Rabbi Eliezer Omer, he still has to be po to her and give her her ketuvah together with her divorce, and nothing has changed. Just because the actual wording, I will take you back to be my wife, does not apply, because he can't, but it's incidental that that's true. It just happens to have worked out. But it wasn't a function of her being kidnapped. Seems to be exactly the same as the issue between Abaye and Rava, right? And Rabbi Yehoshua says, no, he does have to give her the ketuvah, obviously, but he does not have to pay for the ransom. Why? Lechora, because of the fact that he can't take her back as a wife, and therefore the clause is no longer in effect. Omar Rabbi Natan, Sha'alti et Sumchus. I asked Sumchus specifically that when Rabbi Yehoshua said, Notein la ketuvata ve'eno podeh, what exactly was the case? Was that in a case where first he had made this neder against her, which was the first step towards divorce, and then she was captured? Or was it that he even did that after, and in the end, he went ahead and was madir her? And even though, I mean, you'd say, well, you know, it's a pretty sneaky way of getting out of having to pay the ransom, you know? So now you say, well, yeah, what can I do? I couldn't take her back because I made a netter. Yeah, right. That's why you made the netter. Who are you fooling? So, but the question is, are we cushioned for that, or is this actually the same case? Omar Lee Sumchus said to me, I never heard how it is that Rabbi Yehoshua was actually paskening, but I could tell you my opinion. I mean, near in Dvarim, it certainly seems to me that it's talking about a case only where he dira The Neder had existed. He had no idea that she was going to be kidnapped, and then she was kidnapped. Because if you're going to allow this to be in effect, even if he makes a Neder after the kidnapping, then we very much have to be choshesh that Otila Arume, he could come and figure out a way of getting out of his chiyuv to pay the ransom by claiming, well, I can't be Mekayim the Tanai of the Ketuvah because I have a Neder and I can't take her back as a wife. Anyway, but what do you think that the machlokas here is? I believe that we're talking about basically the same idea of Abaye and Rava. I mean, these Tanoim over here seem to be arguing that if you have a case where anyway, the Kohen, because that's where it would be Nogea, you have a case where a Kohen anyway is not going to be taking her back, right? He can't take her back. Why can't he take her back? Because she's a surah to him because of the very fact that she was Nishbet. So Abaye is saying that in the case of an Amon HaLekohen Gadol, he's going Aliba de Rebbe Eliezer, and Rava is going Aliba de Rebbe Yeshua. Because, I mean, I'm sort of taking for granted that, of course, if a Yisrael does a Neder, so how could there be a Machlokas? I mean, the Nusach of the Yisrael's Ksuva is that I will take you back. And he can't take her back, right? So anyway, the whole din shouldn't take effect. So we must be talking about where Lamaisa, he would have to be part of her even if he's not able to take her as a wife. And therefore, the question is whether the Yidira makes a difference. So Rabbi Eliezer says, look, the fact that he was madir her doesn't impact in any way the insurance policy. Because anyway, there was no possibility of his marrying her. And this is because of that, even though it's not related to the fact that she was captured, but it still is absolutely the same tonight as it was before, which seems to be exactly what Abaye is saying, because he said that even though she was asura to him because of the marriage, nonetheless, we would still insist that what do we care why she's asura? Bottom line is that he promised in the Ksuva that he's going to pay the ransom, even though she can't be his wife, right? So who cares how many factors there are involved in his her not being able to be his wife? And Rava was saying, no, it can't be a factor that is unrelated to the kidnapping. If there's any way something that would be asur to him, let's say she's an Amon HaLekohen Gadol, or he's madir her, so then the fact that it happens to work out according to the way that he wrote the Ksuva, obviously is not the primary intent of why it is that we phrased it that way. We phrased it that way just because nobody did anything wrong, and that's part of ipso facto having been captured and kidnapped, right? So if that's the case, then l'chor it's the same achlokas. No, this is the Gemara. You're jumping to conclusions over here, for heaven's sakes. What we're talking about over here could be a completely different issue. You don't know who made the neder. It says that there was a neder. There's two ways of a woman being in a position of being a surah on her husband, right? One is she makes the neder. She swears that she's not going to have any hanah from him. She becomes a surah, and now it's up to him to be mekayim that neder or to be made for that neder. So what he does is he wasn't made for the neder. He's mekayim the neder for her, right? So she went ahead and ushered herself. So, Rabbi Eliezer says, in a case like this, basically, since it was the simplest thing in the world for him to simply cancel that neder, and we view a neder like that as just being a woman making trouble. She knows perfectly well her husband is going to be matir the neder for her, and so she just wants to register her complaint, like saying, I want a divorce. You know, she makes a neder, big deal. But tomorrow morning she forgot it, and she wants money for going out with her friends. So if that's the point, so then he, by going ahead and being mekayim that neder, so what she did is she put her finger between his teeth, so to speak, but he bit it. So for all intents and purposes, it was Hu Noten Etzba Ben Shinei. I mean, look, the way to do it is to understand. She made a problem for herself, right? So now the question is, Okay, but who's at fault? Reb Eliezer says, look, it's as if he put her finger and had her chomp down on her finger. It's his fault that it was actually a netter. She was assuming, you know, he's going to take care of it. Reb Yeshua says, what kind of craziness is that? She puts her finger between her own teeth and she bites it. But he's mechuyev to save her from the implications of her netter? No, he's not mechuyev. So because of that, why are we looking to him as the one who is responsible? So according to Rabbi Yeshua, she bites her own finger off. Well, who told her to make a netter? So because of that, she canceled that part in the ketubah that said, I'll take you back to be a wife. It's your own choice. You don't want to have that clause, then you will not be covered in the event of a kidnapping. So that means there's absolutely no connection between these two machlokes and Abaye and Rava arguing about external causes, and Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer is just arguing about a completely different issue about where we view the responsibility to making a marriage impossible because of a netter. Says the Gemara, that doesn't make any sense. If Rabbi Yeshua holds that she caused the divorce by putting her own finger between her teeth and biting it off, so I don't understand. Why are we talking about a ksuva? What ksuva? Why should you get it? She shouldn't get any ksuva at all. What do you mean? Is the tenai of the ksuva applicable? She dissolved the marriage. She caused the marriage to be impossible. She's asura to be with him. So that's not his responsibility. Obviously, if she manages to dissolve the marriage, which he did over here, so we shouldn't be talking about a particular tenai of the ksuva. It's not ksuva. Furthermore, Omar Rabbi Natan, and remember that at the end, what did it say? That Rabbi Natan said, I ask Sumches, Kishom Rabbi Yeshua, Noten laktuvata ve'eno podeh. Is that Dafka where the netter was made, and then with no knowledge that one was related to the other, then she was kidnapped? Or do we say it's talking about even where she was kidnapped first, and then whoever it was made the netter, and he said, I don't know. I didn't hear. Now, can you explain that to me? The way you've just explained it, that she was the one who made the netter, what possible difference does it make? The only reason that we said there's a problem is because we were nervous about whether the man would use this as a modality to get out of paying the insurance policy, right? So he won't have to pay for the ransom, but he didn't even, the way you're learning it, the whole thing is crazy. She made the netter. What do you mean, Eli? How is he going to be able to get her to make the netter? That's crazy. So that means the very fact that you're raising this issue means that the whole approach that you have over here is completely wrong. That cannot be what we're talking about over here. So then maybe we were right. Maybe the Machlokas Abaye v'Rava is precisely the Machlokas Tanayim. No, okay, not necessarily, because I could still tell you a way that it works out, that there's no relationship between the two Machlokas. Albeit I was wrong about this idea. But there's an alternative. I'll tell you what the alternative is. Liyolam, you're right. It's got to be talking about that he made the netter, because only if he made the netter does that last discussion about whether we have to worry that maybe he'll use making the netter as a way out of paying the ransom. I agree. He made the netter, okay? Nonetheless, both Abaye v'Rava can understand the Machlokas Tanoim in a fashion in which both Tanoim agree with them. Each one can claim both Tanoim agree. Here's what Abaye will say. Abaye will say, look, the case of the Almana L'Kohen Gadol that I claim is covered by the insurance policy because anyway, he never promised to take her back and to be her husband, obviously, right? So who cares whether she was a surah for some other reason? That's what I was saying. So I say, Kulei Amal Plige, the Chayav Livdotah. In that case, there is lo machlokas tanoim at all, and it doesn't matter that there's an external issue that's involved, namely the fact that anyway, he's usur to her. I say that was not the machlokas over here at tanoim. In the case of the mamzeret, or the netina, who's married to Yisrael, everybody agrees also, like we said, that there is no chiv because it violates the conditions of the insurance policy. The policy is that I promise a ransom payment in the event that I take her back as a wife. And I can't take her back for a wife if she's a mamzeret or a netinah. Furthermore, in the case where someone is Madir, an Eishes Kohen, also I say that everybody agrees, because this is my approach. It's no difference from needing to be poda amonu kohen gadol than there is to be poda a woman who is asura to this kohen because of a neder. You're just adding another reason. Okay, fine. She's a surah because she's captured. She's a surah because she's an Amon HaLakoi and God. Oh, maybe she's also a surah because she was Madir. Or either because whatever the case is, I don't care how many reasons you add. The bottom line is that there is a guarantee to pay ransom, even though I cannot take you back as a wife. So if there's 20 reasons for why I can't take you back as a wife, it's still going to be covered by the same insurance policy. That's what I hold, okay? And I don't think that that is anything to do with the Machlokas Tanoim. I'll tell you what the Machlokas Tanoim over here is. Where someone was Madir and Eishes Yisroel. That's the point. And it's talking over here that Rebbe Eliezer holds, look, when I made this guarantee, whenever it is that we made the clause in the Ksuva, it's at that point that it goes into effect. Was she Re'uya to me then? Yes, she was Re'uya to me then. So according to Rebbe Eliezer, so at the time that he made that promise, he is certainly was in a position, that's when he said, I'm going to take you back. And the idea was that he could take her back. There was nothing going on at that point. So that means that he was Mechayev himself to this woman as she is. Something happens later on. This is the question, whether something happens later on changes retroactively the insurance policy. That's the Machlokas. What does that have to do with me and Rava? Absolutely nothing. So Rabbi Yoshua says, look, the question is always currently, can I take her back? No. So then I'm not going to be able to be Mekayim the insurance policies that says I will take her back. That's what we look at. We don't look at it, what it meant at the time that it was made. And Rava will say, on the contrary, everybody agrees with me. I would say that in the case of the Almana Kohen Gadol, or in the case of the Mamzeret and Netina Yisrael, the way I see it, in both cases, she definitely does not have the beneficiary status of this guarantee for paying a ransom. Because the guarantee was made only in terms of whether the captivity is what ossers her, but not if there's something else that ossers her, like an Amar Lekohen Gadol. So that's just a coincidence. It happens to be you're trying to read the small print, and now you're taking the small print, and you're saying, well, according to the small print, it's not about the small print. We understand what the point was in the Ksuva. Let's not be silly. So therefore, I say in those cases, no question. Now the question is, what about the case where there was a Madir? So there, and again, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Eishes Kohen, we're talking about Eishes Yisroel. Basically, it's the same issue. Does it go according to Rabbi Eliezer Asa Basar Mikora and Rabbi Yoshua Asa Basar Basayf? So basically, Abaya and me could have the same approach over here to the Machlokas Tanoim, and it would still have absolutely nothing to do with our understanding of whether external factors are covered by the small print, which is a completely different issue. Now, it says over there in the Mishnah, the din is that the Tanai simply says, Nishbet Chayav Livdota. And the question is whether this is a chiyav that comes into effect on the property of the husband the moment that he finds out about it. So let's imagine a case like this. The husband finds out, he gets a telephone call from the kidnappers to meet him with the ransom. He gets a heart attack and dies on the spot. Do his heirs have to pay, since at that moment, the chiyav to cover the ransom was already chal on the husband? Interesting question. So, I mean, in a case where it was never chal on him, he had a heart attack before. So then you can't come to the heirs and say that the tnai of the ketuvah is chal on them. There was never any chiyav on them. It was only chiyav on the husband. So the question is like this. If she was nishbet b'chaye ba'ala, and then her husband dies. So then if the husband knew about it, at that moment he became chayav, and he kirba ba'ala, he got the message from the kidnappers, then the yorshim are chayavim livdota. If the husband never found out about it before he died, en yorshim chayavim livdota. Now, Levi wanted to actually put that into practical halacha. So Levi sever lemevad uvda ki homas nisa. He wanted to do what it said over here and to pasken in his bezdin. Omer le Rav, I can tell you that my dear uncle, Ochi Omer Chavivi, my dear uncle Reb Chiya, he said, let hilchata ki homatnita. We don't pasken like this brayta. We pasken like the other brayta. And here's the other brayta. L'keo d'tanya, nishbeit li'achar mitat ba'ala. If the kidnapping occurred after the death of the husband, at that point, yes, you're 100% right. At that point, since the kidnapping was something that never took place in the life of the husband, so then there was never any chiyav for the insurance policy. At that point, the Yisomim are not chayev to pay for the ransom. Not only that, but even if nishbeit b'chayei ba'ala, v'achar kach meit ba'ala, eina yitomim chayavim liftota. What's more is this tremendous chiddush. What is the language of the insurance policy again? And this is the other opposite way in which we're medayik the lashon. What does it say? It says that I am going to pay the ransom and take you back as my wife. That's going to be very difficult for him when he's dead. So therefore, there's no way to be mechayev him. So you can't be mechayev the tomim and say, well, it went into effect. That's all very nice, but there's no way to be mechayev the tanai, which was not merely to pay the ransom. It was to pay the ransom and take you back as a wife. So according to the second brisa, it really makes no difference. The point is that the yitomim are never able, even if you would say it kicked in, are never able to be mekayim that tanai. Tana Rabbanan, nishbeit, let's say that she was kidnapped, and they were demanding an extremely high ransom. Are you mevakshimenu ad asara b'damel? They're asking 10 times her worth on the open market, trying to take advantage of his feelings for her. So if this happens once, he can pay it and has to pay it. But after that, it's up to him. Rotsa pode, rotsa eno pode, whatever he wants, because this is not a chiev. The chiev, Rashi says the chiev is that the insurance policy is provided once. Now, there's a very good reason for that, obviously, because once kidnappers are successful and they see that this guy will pay the ransom, then if we put him into this position, then basically you're opening the door to encouraging your kidnapping. So because of that, Rashi understands that there's only one time that we were mechayev him, and therefore the second time she's kidnapped, even if it wouldn't have been for more than Dameha, then we would not be mechayev. Okay, that's Rashi. Shita Tosfos Argus says, no, that it's only if you're talking about having paid more. However, there is another Shita, which is very important, as you know, historically in unfortunate Jewish history, which is that Reb Shimon ben Gamliel Omer ein podina tashvuyin ever for more than they're worth on the open market. Mipnei tikkun ha'olam. Because once you start paying more than these kidnappers would get for a slave on the slave market, you are encouraging them to take action against the kind of people that this was the story with the Merami Rotenberg, who refused to allow the pidyon that was demanded for him and instead insisted that he stay kidnapped. And this is exactly the reason, because this is part of the Tikkun HaOlam. Okay, this main sugya, we'll take a look in Gittin, so we won't go into the details here. But this would mean that if you're talking about their demanding more than her value, we wouldn't even do it once. It's usher to do that. This is Takona because Tikkun HaOlam, which we know the horrors that because of the fact that the Israeli government doesn't hold of this, we know the awful things that have happened because of it and how many lives were lost because of it. Okay, but mashmi here, that there is no limit to how much you would have to pay in terms of what her ksuva is. In other words, There's no upper limit of the ksuva. It seems to be saying it can't be more than she's worth, but it could be more than the ksuva is for, right? That's what the implications are. So habichdei demeim, as long as they're not asking an exorbitant amount in terms of the open market, then even though it's worth more than the money of a ksuva, so they're asking more than matayim for a besula, or more than mana for an almana, we would still, the insurance is more than the value of a ksuva, which is fascinating. If the whole idea of the provision for the woman's protection is the idea that is based on the Mora Betulot and so on, the fact that we would add conditions that are worth more than that is shocking, because, I mean, l'chorah, there ought to be a ceiling, right? The ceiling being her ketuva. V'ramini, we see that it says that nishbet v'yumim v'akshimim menu adasara b'ketuvata pam rishona poda b'kan v'elech rotza poda rotza ena poda. And Rav Shimon ben Gamliel omer, no. The maximum, the ceiling at the insurance policy is the face value of the ketuvah. But in lav, eno poder, because since it's only a tanai of the ketuvah, so the tanai of the ketuvah shouldn't be more than the ketuvah itself. So whatever the ketuvah was, that should limit the ransom payment. So that means that what Rabbi Shimon Galil is saying is a stira to what he own psak was mashma in the brisa before, that it's not limited by the ksuva, it's only limited by how much above the market value it is, right? No, not right. You're the one who's assuming that if it says X, it means and not Y, and if it says Y, it means not X. It's not true. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel trei kulei itle. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel basically is saying that if either of them, in other words, if it's higher than her market value, or if it hits the ceiling of the ksuva, so then there's no chiyuv. So the two are completely interrelated. He needs both of them. Now let's take the next case. She becomes ill. He is mechuyev to pay her medical bills. Tana Rabbanan. Almana nizonet michse yetomim. Now we know that the din of mizonot is beferish. We're going to get to this very soon. The language of the clause in the ketuvah that provides for the continued support of the almana. So even if the husband died, the orphans who are his heirs, they are mechuyev to pay for her support. And if she's a tzricha refuah, so if she needs to be supported in terms of the extended mizonos of what her body needs, which is beyond food, but she needs medical help, that's the same as mizonot, like we said before. And since both of those things are sustenance, medication and food are both the sustenance for a continued ability to survive, they're mechuyev for both of them. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel again says, there's ceilings that are provided over here. It's not so pasha. A refuah, she yesh la kitzba, nitrapet miktuvata. So this woman basically has got a problem. This problem, let's say, could be corrected surgically. So the doctor gives you a bill for the surgery. It's a one-time expense. So then, if that's the case, then the halacha is that it comes out of her ketuvah. Because you can't call it an ongoing mizonot. It's basically an insurance policy for medical care. So obviously it doesn't cover any medical care. It covers up to the same ceiling that I believe was in effect for kidnapping, which is the maximum value of the ketuvah. You give her the ketuvah, let her pay for the surgery. But if she's chronically ill, so then she needs constant medication. This means that every day she needs medicine together with her food. And there it's the same as food, in the same way that we couldn't put an upper limit to her ksuva if it's going to be, who knows, maybe 20 years, 40 years, she'll be still being nizon from the estate. How can we provide for her by putting a limit of the ksuva? That's mizonos. Mizonos doesn't have a limit. Omar Rabbi Yochanan, Asu Hakazat Dam Be'eretz Yisrael, Kirufua She'ein La Kitzba. Remember that in Eretz Yisrael, like it used to be not that long ago in the U.S., the idea of requiring constant bloodletting, it was a standard of an ongoing care. So if that is something that's done all the time, then it doesn't have any kind of kitzvah. And in Eretz Yisrael, that's the way that they did it. Now, there were some relatives of Rabbi Yochanan, and they had a problem because their father had died, and he left an almana. And that almana was costing them so much money, she needed a refuah kol yuma. So they came to Rabbi Yochanan, is there anything that we can do over here? I mean, it's like, this is crazy. So he said to them, look, what you can do is you have to find a doctor who is willing to commit himself to ongoing care for an upfront payment. So if you do that, then you're making it basically, you're turning it into a one-time thing that doesn't have a lo kitzvah. Then it becomes the kitzvah. So then once it becomes the kitzvah, then we treat it. If it's now a fixed expense, then it's not mizaynus anymore. So then you've taken something which until now was considered to be mizaynus, and now you're going to have a way out of it because it's going to be limited by the maximal value of the ksuva. And then Rabbi Yochanan was really upset with himself. What the hell is wrong with me? What, I think I'm a lawyer over here that I'm going to be giving now etzes because they're my relatives. So I'm going to tell them how they can mess her up and they can go into court. And they can, oh my God, what did I do? You know, asinu atzminu k'orchei hadayanim, I turned myself into a lawyer. Oh my God. I understand. So what was he thinking? I mean, it must have been a svara that he understood that what he was doing was giving an etza for being makif, the limitations. Like what? Because mikora, mikora sova, it says in the pasuk, umi b'sorecha lo titalam. You're mechuyev to come and help your shared flesh, your relatives. And these people are my relatives. So I'm mechuyev to use my Torah learning to be able to help them out. It's a very tough situation. And at the end, he held that that's true, that he really was in a position where the mitzvah was to help them out. But nonetheless, at the end, he realized that since he is an Adam Chashuv, it looks very bad. And other people will think that you can stand be an Arech Din. You know, so they'll give aids to people in general, not because of the chiyav amib sarcha lo titalam. Because of that, he held he should have been machmer anyway. I think we're ready for our kapitan here.
But Rabbi didn't drink. During the zukt, it was a beautiful zukt.
It was a beautiful zukt. You know, I usually have someone who cares about me, and he makes a l'chaim while the zukt is going on, especially on a Rosh Chodesh. You'd think that he would make a l'chaim. I was looking, and honestly, I really was. I was looking and looking. And apparently, it's no longer important that I survive. So I figure, okay, I guess he's looking forward to giving the daf maybe in my place. I don't know. But he certainly doesn't seem to care about my drinking. L'chaim.
I came late, so I couldn't tell what Rebbe had done beforehand.
I see. It was a pretty long time, but okay. Anyway, so as our dear Kapitan has mentioned, Zok the Halakha Mishnah. So the other things that we haven't yet gone into the details of, but we know all about them because we've spoken about them a lot, we finally get to the specific Mishnah that tells us the clauses, the three clauses that we really talked about from the very beginning, which is Benin Dichrin and Benot Nukvan, and then the actual Almanas Tanai, that Ate Yatva, Bebeti, etc. So let's go through them. Suppose, remember, we're continuing now the previous Mishnah that started with the idea if If he managed to get away without writing her ksuva, it's still going to be chal. And whatever it is, that if he didn't say that I'm going to be paying your ransom, he's still going to be paying ransom, and so on. So we're continuing now with other tana'e aktuva. So these are additional clauses that appear in the ksuva, which the Mishnah wants to tell us makes no difference if you write them or you don't write them. It's still going to go into effect. So if he didn't write the clause, which technically goes like this, any males that you have with me, they are going to inherit any monies that are coming in due to your ketuvah, above and beyond anything that they share with my other heirs. So this piece will be sequestered, will be only split among them, and it will not affect the rest of the Arusha for them. They're still going to get anything else. Now, of course, this does not only mean the money of the ketuvah. It means all of the monies that the ketuvah are mechayev, which includes all of the things that she brought in, the nechassim, and so all of those things. That is the main point, and that could be a lot of money. So, I mean, if her father had given her, you know, a home to bring in, so then that means that the value of that home is only going to accrue to the heirs of his that are also her children. Okay, that's benin dichrin. The next one, if he leaves out, anyway, he's still going to pay it. Chayev shu tanai beitin. The next one that he might leave out is benan nukban. What is the tanai benan nukban? Here's the language. Benan nukban diyahavin lechiminoi. So any female kids that you have with me, yehavayun yatvan bebeitiyu mitzanan minichasai adeti lakchun lejuvrin, then he's still going to be chayev. So they're going to live in the house on the estate. They're going to be supported by the estate until they are taken by men. He's going to have to do that whether he writes it or not. Chayav, again, it's a tanai beit din. Whatever is a tanai beit din, there's no way he can get out of it. The other tanai, the very important tanai of mizonot for the widow, that reads as follows. You are going to continue to live in my home and be supported by the estate so long as you remain a widow in my home. We're going to see the meaning of all these diyukim. He's still going to have to provide mizonos because, again, this is a tanai beit din. So kacha yuanche Yerushalayim kotvim. This was the way that they used to write word for word, that it's a function of as long as she's happy remaining as a widow, meaning she doesn't marry somebody else and move out, and she doesn't demand payment of her ksuva, which indicates that she wants to strike out on her own. So she's still living in the estate. Anshei Galil, hayu kotvim ganshei Yerushalayim. In the Galil, they wrote the same language. So it started apparently in Yerushalayim and was adopted by Anshei Galil. Anshei Yehuda hayu kotvim. However, in Yehuda, they wrote it differently, which makes a tremendous difference to halacha, because what they would write was, "Achi yirtzu ayorshim liten lach tuvateich." You'll be supported by the estate until such time as my heirs want to pay you off. Lefichach, so according to that, in Yehuda, im ratzu ayorshim, if they would prefer, then they always have a way out. Notnim lach tuvato potrinota. They can give it a ktuva as a lump payment. And even if she wants to stay in the house, and it means that she was left on her own. So that means that they weren't makbid to continue to support. We're Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. What's the reason for the Benin Dichrin? I mean, it's sort of like a violation of the concept of Yerusha, isn't it? I mean, the Torah says you're supposed to give all your kids evenly. It doesn't say anything about providing for a specific woman's children. So, like, why did they do such a thing? To change the derech of the Yerusha of the Torah? So, kidei sheyikpots adam v'yichtov levito kivno. The reason is that we want people to be willing to get up there, stand up for their daughter, provide for them enough money so that people will be willing to take them as wives, and it would be as if they were their own sons. Because like this, nobody was worried about leaving money to his son because it'll stay in the family. But if they give money to their daughters, how's it going to stay in the family? It's going to end up being watered down by wherever other children are going to appear in the household that she married into. So they're not going to be willing to like give, okay, they'll give something, you know, but they're not going to make it attractive for people to marry her because she's got so much money. So even if they are a wealthy family, they're not going to share it with her, because in the end, they're going to say, listen, it's going to leave the family. Why should we send it to her? We'll give it to the sons, where we know that it still remains attached to our family and our family name. We don't want that to happen. Well, I don't understand what you're saying. The Torah says not like you. And you've decided that you have a better idea than God. I mean, so what kind of business is that? I mean, I think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as a lover of us and as having rachamim and so on, you don't think you can trust him? He says that the males should be yoresh, not the females. Now the rabbanim are going to come along and they say, we know better. And they're going to mitakne the tirot barta. Essentially what they're saying is that the inheritance should go through the daughter. Is this correct? I mean, basically any money that the father gives away in this marriage for his daughter is, for all intents and purposes, an inheritance of his property that's going to be passing to his daughter and not to his sons, because he gave it away to her. And then the Yerusha of it is going to be defined by her. Why would they do that? Says the Gemara, because the Torah hints that this is also a chiyuv. Hanami diraita. Because we find in Yirmiyahu that it says, Kichu nashim, v'holidu banim uvanot, ukhulav nechem nashim, vet benotechem tenu la'anashim. So we're saying over there how it is that you're going to have to make do in a gullus, and you're going to have to recognize that life is different and that you figure out the way to fit in with a society that is so rochok from what you're used to. So just keep living in a human way. Take women, have sons, have daughters, see to it that your sons get married, and give your daughters to men. Now, I understand there are ways that you can marry your sons off, but how in the world can you marry your daughters off? I mean, you got to find somebody who's stupid enough to get married to them. So what are you supposed to do? I mean, you can go looking around for a wife for your son, but how can you persuade a man to marry your daughter? So how come Mashmal? So what is it telling us, basically? It's telling us that Navi is saying that you're going to have to take the responsibility for decking her out. The Nalbasha, Venichsa, Venesiv Lamide, you've got to actually deck her out, both deck her out in clothing, make her look beautiful, give her a big bank account, make it reasonable for people to want to marry her, encourage them to marry her. I mean, otherwise it makes no sense. It's like you can do. So this is going to cost you money, and it's saying that you should invest in a future that's going to be using this money for your daughter. Okay, so apparently that is also a chiyuv. And how much is it correct to go and to give for a daughter, even though it's taking it away from the sons? It's up to 10% of the estate. We're going to talk about, obviously, if there's a lot of children, we're going to talk about what to do later on about that. So now the question is like this. How about if the father, for instance, I mean, does it make sense? There's a lot of things that are not absolutely clear, because what we should say over here is that the sons are the ones that should inherit, but the Baal, they should actually lo lirot. I mean, why would they? I understand if the point is that we want daddy to give money, what does that have to do with the money that is coming from the husband, right? If she dies first, So then why should they have a right to the ksuva? The ksuva? I mean, that's not something that your father put in, your grandfather, not your grandfather put in. No, because look, the point is over here. If the guy is going to act in such a way and he's going to say that the husband is like really very careful to make sure none of his money is going to go to his grandchildren. So that's the kind of guy that he is. That what the money that he had to pay out, he wants to pay that out in such a way that it goes to all of his kids and they're going to share in the money that my daughter was supposed to get. Ah, if that's what kind of guy he is, I don't want to invest either. He doesn't want to share anything. I don't want to share anything. So because psychologically it's going to make things difficult, and the whole point is that we're trying to encourage people to invest in their daughters, we don't do that either. Because imkein avnami mimne velo katab. Okay, but then why don't we make it dependent on the reality? If the father actually invested some kind of decent dowry, so then the benin dichrin should go get it. But if the father didn't invest, so then why should he have to give the ksuva, which is his money? I mean, the father wasn't responding. That we can't start making it dependent on the particular case. Okay, then let me ask you something else. How about if you have a daughter and she's a bat bein habanim? So then if she is, there's boys over here from another marriage, right? And she only had a daughter. So why don't we give all the money to the daughter? Why do we only give it to benin dichrin? You said we're going to limit it to the male children. Why should we do that? I mean, we're trying to encourage father to invest. I mean, he certainly doesn't want his money to be watered down with all of these male children who are not his grandchildren and not related to him in any way. And he would much prefer that his money goes to his granddaughter. So why didn't we go and make a takana to give it to the granddaughter? No, the Rabbanan are treating this as an inheritance. They're going to make new laws of inheritance, for heaven's sakes. But if the Torah didn't give the daughter a place as inheritance, it's not going to create an inheritance of a daughter. Okay, but what about if there's only daughters? So she had a daughter, and then three other wives had six daughters apiece. I don't know, whatever it is. So all of it, if anyway, the only ones that are going to be getting Yerush is a daughter, so then that single daughter should be the one to inherit all of the money that her rich daddy had put into the marriage, right? Look, we made a standard of how it is that we write the benin dichrin. We're not going to have a specific case, but if there is a daughter, that wasn't necessary in order for the takara to work. But if this is true, then tigvei mimetaltalei. Why can't she collect all this money even from metaltalein? And we said before that this is only true in the case of actual real estate. So, I mean, if the idea is whatever the father put in, so then it should go even from metaltalein. Because the Rabbanan made all of the Tanai Ketuvah similar to the Ketuvah, namely that at least at the time of the Gemara, it was only collectible from real estate. Okay, so let me ask something else. Let's say that we have benin dichrin. You're saying it's the same as a ksuva. So then they should be able to recover any money that had been brought in by the father, even if the husband had sold it. And they should be able to be terefit from mishabde. Ah, that's because, remember, every word, the way that it is phrased, is very precise. What's the language in the Mishnah? Yartun. It says they shall inherit, which means yartun, that they are given dinim only the power of an heir. Does an heir have the right to go in and be tore flakuchos? No. So therefore, they don't have the power to be tore flakuchos. It's the same idea. So, okay, but where'd you come up with the idea of needing a motar dinar? Remember that we had a klal that the din of benin dichrin only applies if there was at least $1 worth of property that was left over that would actually be split equally among all the heirs. But if after giving all the benin dichrin their shares, there's not a dollar left to split evenly, then there's no benin dichrin to any of the children. So why is that? Because we're welcome to come akronach l'diaraisa, lo tekinu rabbanan, don't make a takona that is going to cancel the actual din b'diraisa, because even though we say this also raisa, I mean, it means that it's merumis in the Torah and that it's a good thing. But certainly, we're not going to cancel the ikur din of Yerusha for this particular tnai of an indichrut. Tomorrow, we're going to see some fascinating actual stories about how these things get carried out and the type of social problems that they lead to, as we'll see. Be'ezrat Hashem.